The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And after tonight, folks, they'll be dropping like flies. Those faces in the GOP debates will start to dwindle. And not because of some issue with Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly. It'll be so long to the Carsons, Kasichs and Christies, the Fiorinas and Bushes and Pauls. Actually, I have no idea who will be in or out of the presidential race after Iowa and New Hampshire, but I have a strong suspicion that Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Donald Trump will both be in. They topped the polls with Trump way out in front nationally and a significant 7 points ahead of Senator Cruz in Iowa alone. Trump will be doing his own thing, of course, you've no doubt heard, in a special event at Drake University with veterans that he might as well call the 2016 Outfox Fox campaign. Trump's event will compete with the Fox broadcast debate in Des Moines. Trump's way of saying that apparently he won't be on any stage if anchor Megyn Kelly is asking the questions. The audience numbers for these events 2 miles apart may reveal something about the voters, but we're not going to know anything real about voter preferences until the Iowa caucuses on February 1st and the New Hampshire primary on February 9th. But this hour, we are going to try and imagine what would happen in the first days of a Republican administration if one of these frontrunners won in November. We're going to focus on Senator Ted Cruz and pose the question, would his policies make good on some of his rhetoric? Here he is speaking about ISIS and the situation in Iraq and Syria.
You would carpet bomb where ISIS is, not a city, but the location of the troops. You use air power directed, and you have embedded special forces to direct the air power. But the object isn't to level a city. The object is to kill the ISIS terrorist.
There you go. So what would a President Ted Cruz foreign policy look like? Dr. Victoria Coates is Ted Cruz's foreign policy advisor. She holds a Ph.D. in art history and has worked for Donald Rumsfeld and Rick Perry. We reached out to her for some Ted Cruz context in foreign affairs.
Well, Senator Cruz for the last 3 years has been diligent about building a very, very clear record of defending American interests. It sounds very simple, but approaching the world from the very clear perspective of what's best for America, how do we defend our nation, because he believes our nation is the greatest force for good on the planet, and so preserving it and protecting it should be our priority. That's been a very disciplined practice of his.
What do you make of some of the rhetoric of Senator Cruz talking about carpet bombing the Middle East, references to making the sand glow, audience-grabbing rhetoric, but is that really, from your perspective as an academic, the kind of talk from a presidential candidate that contributes to international peace and security?
Well, I'm never going to apologize for working for a candidate who wants to be too mean to the terrorists. That doesn't seem to me really to be a downside.
And I don't want to interrupt you here, except that if you carpet bomb the Middle East and make the sand glow, you're probably going to get a few people besides the terrorists.
Well, this is true. And unfortunately, we're in a situation right now where we have an administration that has zero tolerance for any collateral damage. And unfortunately, as you know, war is a horrible, violent, messy business. And one can be as humane as humanly possible. And if one is going to successfully execute a military mission, there is going to be collateral damage. So I think very much what Senator Cruz is expressing is his willingness to do what is necessary to keep our country safe.
I don't want to play logic games with you, but it sounds like you're saying we judge the effectiveness and resolve of a military initiative by the amount of collateral damage we're willing to tolerate?
No, not at all. But I think what you've seen, unless you'd like to say that President Obama's mission against ISIS over the last, 16 months has been a success, that we need to change the rules of engagement that are governing our forces if we do want to be successful. Now, if you want to argue that we have been successful against ISIS, then that's one thing. But I would argue that this has been really a pretty dismal failure to take any effective action against them.
The Obama administration is accused of 90% rate of killing innocents in drone strikes in Afghanistan and on Pakistani territory. That doesn't exactly speak of a zero tolerance for collateral damage. Would you say that those drone strikes that kill innocents are a mistake or are part of the dirty business of war?
Well, it's a very curious. I agree that there is a disconnect there between what they will tolerate in terms of the AFPAC region in drone strikes and what they are willing to tolerate in Iraq and Syria against ISIS. So I can't explain their logic. It is a great mystery to me. One thing that has been a concern to me about this administration is that they have almost fetishized the use of drones. I mean, drones are a useful technology. They can do all sorts of extraordinary things. They're going to put lasers on them. They can take out ballistic missiles. That's fantastic. But they remain a tool. They are not a strategy. And if you make prioritizing drone strikes because they are unmanned, that your prime goal, which I fear the administration has done in some cases, then you wind up, I think, with unintended consequences, which may be the collateral damage you're describing.
Would Senator Cruz advocate the building of a forward operating base in Gaziantep, Turkey, to actually put boots on the ground in Syria, if not an actual invasion?
No.
Would Senator Cruz revoke the Iran nuclear deal if he becomes president?
He would, on day one.
On day one. And what do you think the collateral effect of that would be?
Well, I mean, he's been very clear over the last 2 years, really since September 13, that he felt the very initiation of this diplomatic exchange, even before the infamous phone call between President Rouhani and President Obama, that we were starting out on the wrong foot. He filed legislation, I think, the day before the filibuster when he had other things on his mind, but it was enough of a priority for him to file legislation insisting that our hostages be released and the Iranians recognized Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state before we had any contact. For this administration, it came after. It was some sort of postscript to get the hostages out. And it, for me, that's a pretty clear illustration of the differences of their approach. And so I think certainly it's going to be a very heavy lift. But that doesn't mean he's not going to do it.
If he does it, it'll be clear, according to the international monitors, that Iran will restart its nuclear program. So the effect of revoking it will actually be restarting the nuclear program, which would then beg the question, what will Senator Cruz do then?
That's based on the premise that they've ever stopped it.
So you don't believe anything that the Secretary of State has said?
No, I don't.
And you don't believe anything the Iranians have said, and you don't believe anything that the UN nuclear monitors have said?
I absolutely believe a number of things the Iranians have said, which is that they believe they have a right to enrich uranium, they believe that they have a right to ICBMs, that they believe that they can keep testing them in defiance of the United Nations Security Council. I believe them when they say death to America. I believe them when they say they're going to wipe Israel off the map. And all of those statements, which I believe, lead me to be extremely cautious about the agreement that we've just concluded. You can't say signed because it's not.
Right. Finally, the New York Times did a piece where they focused on a lot of people who have been touched by Senator Cruz in one way or another during his academic period of time at Princeton and as a lawyer and as he moved up the food chain in the GOP, if you want to say so, in the Congress, et cetera. The picture that was painted by the New York Times is to know Senator Cruz is to either loathe him or to soon loathe him. And they quoted his former roommate at Princeton, Craig Mazin, who said, "We should be afraid that someone like Senator Cruz would have any power. I would rather have anybody else be president of the United States." There were lots and lots of quotes of people who say that Senator Cruz is just kind of a nasty person one-on-one. I've heard no one in the Cruz campaign comment on that article. What would you say?
Well, let me ask you a quick question. When you were a freshman in college, did you choose your freshman roommate?
No, I didn't.
Did you choose your sophomore year your roommate?
Actually, yes.
That was also the case with me, and it was also the case with Senator Cruz.
But are you still in touch with your roommate, and Are you my friends with
my freshman roommate? No, although we didn't have a bad relationship, but we were put together by my college. We didn't choose to be together. The roommate I chose for sophomore, junior, senior year, yes, I'm still friends with. And that's also the case with Senator Cruz. I think that rather than listening to that individual who, to my knowledge, has never had no contact with him since their freshman year in Princeton and is now a D-list figure trying to get attention in Hollywood, that maybe you should talk to the man who was his sophomore, junior, senior year, and then also Harvard roommate, who went on to be the second black head of the Harvard Law Review after Barack Obama, who remains, you know, was in Ted and Heidi's wedding, remains a very, mm-hmm. very dear friend. I think David might have a lot more to say about his character and what it means to actually care deeply for Ted Cruz than this person who knew him for 9 months, 30 or whatever it was, 20 years ago.
Dr. Coates, thank you so much.
Absolutely a pleasure, John.
Dr. Victoria Coates is foreign policy advisor to GOP presidential candidate Senator Ted Cruz, and she's author of the book David Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art. And now it's time to hear about one more great American invention other than the U.S. Constitution. You've been visiting thetakeaway.org/innovation in droves to choose from our list of innovations or nominate one of your own. What's the greatest American innovation? New York City's former top cop doesn't have to think too hard about that one.
Hello, I'm Ray Kelly, former commissioner of the New York City Police Department. Kevlar stands for just about everything I love about this country. It's strong, it's versatile, and it has impacted thousands of lives, not just in America, but around the world. When I first became a police officer in the 1960s, New York City was a very different place, and Kevlar certainly wasn't part of our uniform. Little did we know that work was being done in the laboratory in Delaware that would transform how our men and women in uniform confront violent situations. And not just on the streets of New York, but in the Middle East, in Africa, in fact, just about everywhere the U.S. military is deployed. At that lab in Delaware, a remarkable chemist named Stephanie Qualick was hard at work. Qualick began experimenting and eventually stumbled across a material that was 5 times the strength of steel. It was given a name and a trademark, and about a decade later, Kevlar was being used to make bullet-resistant vests. Police departments started using Kevlar in the 1970s, and helmets made of Kevlar entered U.S. military service in the 1980s. Today, it's everywhere, from motorcycle gear, to shoes, to cell phones. It's been used in airplanes, bridges, and even butcher's gloves. But most important, Kevlar is responsible for saving the lives of our men and women in uniform. Before Stephanie Qualick died in 2014 at age 90, she said this, "I don't think there's anything like saving someone's life to bring you satisfaction and happiness." You should seriously consider voting for Kevlar as America's greatest innovation.
Ray Kelly on Kevlar. Can you do better? Are you down with Kelly's suggestion? Go vote. Do it now.
Come on. Do it. Do it!
Visit thetakeaway.org/innovation to formally nominate an invention for this challenge or vote for one you've heard on the air. Again, that's thetakeaway.org/innovation. Make your voice heard. It's got to be American. The wheel, for instance, or fire, not going to cut it. I mean, they're really clever, but not American. A horrible mosquito-borne virus, Zika, has caused a frightening scourge in Brazil over the last few months. A dramatic increase in babies born with abnormally small heads, a condition known as microcephalus, which can lead to severe cognitive and motor abnormalities, has been associated with Zika. The Zika virus was first identified in the 1940s in Uganda. Its visible symptoms are seemingly mild, a rash, fever, swollen joints, and reddened eyes, but it produces unseen nerve damage in adults and severe birth defects in babies. Not nearly enough is known about the relatively rare Zika virus. At a special meeting on Thursday, WHO Director General Dr. Margaret Chan said the virus, which has been linked to birth defects and neurological problems, was spreading explosively.
Conditions associated with this year's El Nino weather pattern are expected to increase mosquito populations greatly in many places. The level of concern is high, as is the level of uncertainty.
The WHO will meet next week to decide if Zika should be declared an international health emergency, as Ebola was in 2014 in West Africa. Dr. Marcia Castro is associate professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Welcome to The Takeaway, Doctor.
Hello.
So what do we need to know about Zika virus? How does it work? I'd never heard of it before this report began to emerge from Brazil.
Yeah, so that's the problem. We don't know much about Zika virus. It started in Africa, and in 2013 and 14, we had the largest epidemic so far in French Polynesia. And in fact, that's the hypothesis, that the virus came to Brazil when there was a competition, a canoe competition in preparation for the Olympics that happened in Rio, and there was a team from French Polynesia. And the reason that makes us to believe that that's the connection is because the strain of the virus that we have in Brazil is the same of the Asian strain, not the African one. So that's probably how it got introduced. And the mosquito is all over the country because, we've been endemic for dengue for decades now. So we found the ideal environment to spread. The connection between Zika and microcephaly is just a strong correlation at this point, as Dr. Chan said. But it's kind of scary because since we don't know much about the virus, we don't know the mechanisms, the potential mechanisms that could cause microcephaly. So just to give you an example, only one in five people will have symptoms of Zika. And therefore, we have no idea if a pregnant woman contracts Zika but does not have the symptoms, if that's going to cause or if that's going to generate any problems in the fetus. So there's a lot of unknowns which a little bit ties our hands in terms of what we can do.
So we've got the incidence of microcephalic babies in Brazil, mm-hmm. and we've got evidence of the actual mosquito with this Polynesian strain in mm-hmm. Brazil. But the mechanism in terms of the symptoms presented by a pregnant mother and the then outcome of microcephalic birth, there's no real connection there. It's just sketchy.
Yeah, what we have is we found the virus in the amniotic fluid of one mother and a few babies that died after birth that had microcephaly had some of the organs infected with the virus. That's as much as we know. So there is evidence that the virus can go through the placenta and infect the fetus. But how that works, when during the pregnancy the mother contract the virus and therefore that causes an impact in the fetus, these are all questions that we need to answer. So one problem is we don't have a test for Zika, an effective test for Zika. That's another problem.
So if Zika emerges in the United States and you say it's unlikely that there would be local transmission, it's not an argument for quarantining people. It's an argument for being vigilant about the presence of mosquitoes.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to quarantine people. What you have to do is to have a very, very strict monitoring for breeding habitats and to try to control the mosquito. And as long as you become aware of those cases there and be important, you can treat them soon enough so you can prevent the disease from spreading.
Now, there's no chance I'm going to get someone from Harvard to go out on a limb here, but it just occurred to me, does this have anything to do with climate change or radically different climate temperatures, average temperatures around the world?
Well, the impact of climate change in vector-borne diseases, I mean, for sure there's going to be an impact. But for a country like Brazil, which is already in the tropics, the mosquitoes were already there, there is not much of an impact at this point. In the U.S., we also had the presence of the Aedes albopictus, which is the name of the mosquito here. It was present already. If it's going to expand in the future because of increases of temperature, that is a possibility. But we already have it. And you take the south of the U.S., the southeast of the U.S., the mosquito has been there for a long time. So it's not going to make it worse. The potential for transmission is there already.
Marcia Castro, Dr. Marcia Castro, is associate professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Pleasure talking to you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. How are the folks in Flint doing coping with the human-created disaster in their drinking water? Yesterday, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder held a news conference to ask the federal government to expand Medicaid to anyone under the age of 21 who is exposed to lead. The mayor of Flint has officially hired Virginia Tech professor Mark Edwards, who originally confirmed scientifically the Flint contamination and was a guest on this program earlier this month. Residents showed up last night for a town hall meeting that was broadcast nationally, and Flint native Lanice Lawson, a registered nurse, was there. She said there is still a lot of bitterness about elected officials who waited too long to act.
The politicians who waited, you have poisoned an entire community. So kudos to you.
The news conference that Governor Snyder held didn't do anything to convince you that the situation has changed?
I wasn't convinced at all. As a matter of fact, I attended the State of the State, and I was not moved. He placed a lot of blame, tried to spread the blame evenly, when we know the blame ultimately lied in his hands.
Do you feel like the victim of a man-made, a human-caused disaster? I mean, people really are describing this as a environmental disaster.
Absolutely. And I feel that would be very accurate. And I would even take that a step further and call it a crime against humanity.
And the measures that have been put in homes such as yours to deal with it, are they enough?
Well, actually, they're giving out the water filters at the local fire stations, as well as testing kits. Now, there had been some concerns raised about the water filters. They give out little digital meters. And I spoke with Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, and he wasn't sure. He said that lead couldn't be measured by those devices. Well, when you tested bottled water as opposed to testing the tap water, it registered on that meter. And it was, I didn't know how to take that. But there's a lot of mistrust here, and for good reason.
Well, Mark Edwards knows what he's talking about.
Absolutely.
He's been
Absolutely.
On our program before. I mean, any advice he gives you, I would take. But tell us about the bottled water and its availability. The bottles for the babies fundraiser is something that you've started. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. I started that at the end of September. And to date, we've delivered over 250,000 bottles of water to the community. So there has been a great influx of bottled water into the community. However, having those sources available to say people like me who have our feet on the ground and are pushing that product out into the community so that people get their hands on it, I think that's an issue. We still have schools calling us for water. How could that be? Of course, my initial target was bottles for the babies. But since the state has stepped in and on a federal level as well, we expanded our scope to include the elderly and handicapped and do home deliveries and different things like that. Well, we have schools still calling us with all this water here, and it's hard to believe.
Well, Lanice, that's alarming. There's been so much talk in this story about the racial divide and a sense that the community of Flint was just sort of left to itself because of race and poverty. Has your community come together in the middle of all this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We definitely have. It's really nice to see everyone just banding together to help one another, whether you know each other or not. Race isn't a factor. Class isn't a factor. People have come from all over to help. And it's just been beautiful.
Lanice Lawson, right in the middle of the Flint water crisis, who's a native of Flint, Michigan, a registered nurse, and someone who started the GoFundMe Bottles for the Babies program to bring bottled water, pure bottled water, to residents of Flint who can't get it on their own. Lanice, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Exactly 30 years ago today, barely anyone in America saw this historic event live.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
But that major malfunction was watched live by thousands of school kids participating in the historic mission of the first American civilian to go into space, a science teacher, Krista McAuliffe.
I would like to humanize the space age by giving a perspective from a non-astronaut, because I think the students will look at that and say, this is an ordinary person. This ordinary person is contributing to history. And if they can make that connection, then they're going to get excited about history. They're going to get excited about the future. They're going to get excited about space.
Selected for the Teacher in Space program, Krista McAuliffe from Concord High School in Concord, New Hampshire, was one of the seven crew members who died that day in 1986 in a major malfunction that would become the Challenger disaster, an event that U.S. News and World Report later described as the first ever national trauma on children. Kurt Gergler was a student of Krista McAuliffe's at Concord High School. Kurt, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
How afraid were you and your student colleagues of that scenario that proved to be the disaster of Challenger as you watched her preparations, as you listened to her excitement about the mission?
You know, living in her classroom while she was being selected, it was a building of excitement for her and for the possibilities. If you remember, you know, we hadn't lost anyone in the space program for some time. And being only a teenager, the 60s seemed like eons away, so we didn't really think it was possible that there could be a problem.
And so when major malfunction, and you were told of what had actually happened, you were away in college at the time, what did you feel?
I think it's grief process like many others. It's shock, doubt. I heard about it several hours later from a friend who told me that the Challenger went up, and I was excited for that. Then she said, well, I don't think it's going to come down. And I still didn't grasp that there was any deaths involved. So I went to the TV and started watching. And it took a long time before I realized that, well, they're not coming down. You cycle through doubt, anger, sadness, and back around.
Krista McAuliffe described that as an ordinary person being a part of a shuttle mission, she was going to show people that you could contribute to history. Now, when the Challenger exploded, all that possibility of her goal there could have been dashed. Did it turn you off to space and to teaching in the beginning?
No, it didn't turn me off of having the space program, and definitely didn't turn me off of teaching. Well, at the time, I felt what she did was still brave, and she set a goal and she was a risk taker as a teacher, too. So seeing her do this on this national stage was a natural. But no, I was more grieving her, not so much the mission or the idea of what she was after.
There are more than 40 schools named after Krista McAuliffe. And you yourself went into education. Why do you think this event ended up actually inspiring so many people as opposed to making them fearful about the space program?
Well, listening to her words just a few minutes ago, I think that captures it. You know, she was trying to show that a normal person can do an extraordinary thing. And reading her words, I mean, her words were quite published at the time and ended up being in a book and a movie. So people had a lot of access to her speaking and her normalizing it, having vision, taking risks. Touching the future was her quote. And that resonated with people. You know, we all have had teachers. And so people can relate to their teacher. And she was my teacher and very easy to relate to.
Do you think your contact with Krista McAuliffe has made you a better teacher?
It's hard to say. You know, I respected what she did in my classroom with me. She was engaging. And in that respect, yes, it's someone that I try to emulate. When I think of her, I think of the human side of teaching because she was dynamic. She was engaging. I mean, she knew us. And it seems like a cliche that she knew her students. But she seemed to know us, and when she talked to us, she was talking to us, and it wasn't a separation.
Well, practicing the human side of teaching, Kurt Gergler was once a student of Krista McAuliffe, who died 30 years ago today in the Challenger disaster. Today, Kurt is a principal at Bow Elementary School. Kurt Gergler, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You know, family dinners have a way of being about everything but the food. In the movies, family dinners often bring out the best in people, like this one from the film August Osage County.
Mom needs her lunch, please.
I'm not hungry.
You didn't eat today, you didn't eat anything yesterday.
I'm not hungry.
You're eating. Do what I say. Everyone, do what I say.
Or this one from House Party.
Vita told me you were down home, folks. So I thought we'd have a little soul food dinner, something I know you people would like.
I don't care what you serve, long as it ain't Cajun.
The food looks great, Mom.
After these scenes, who would ever do anything but grab some cold leftovers from the fridge and run back to the bedroom? Someone please give me a suggestion for making family dinner conversation tolerable.
Tell me two truths and a lie about something that happened today. Or tell me a rose, a thorn, and a bud about your day. A rose is something funny or positive. A thorn is something difficult. And a bud is something that you hope will happen tomorrow.
I mean, that certainly beats the what did you do in school today question.
It really does.
I got some real practical advice the other day from Anne Fischel, the director of the Family and Couples Therapy Program at Mass General Hospital and co-founder of the 15-year-old Family Dinner Project. The project is a scientific approach to something I've even noticed in my big family. Family dinner is not about insults and wounding. It can be about real healing.
When families have regular family dinners and they have interesting conversations, mental health benefits and the other benefits just come along for the ride. There have been 20 years of research that's really quite astounding, showing all these benefits. I mean, for example, the conversation that we have at the dinner is a better vocabulary booster even than reading out loud to young kids. Regular family dinners are associated with high achievement, even more so than doing homework or doing sports. Without even trying hard, the family dinners are lower in calories and lower in fat and sugar and salt than restaurant meals. And I think because of this, kids who have regular family dinners tend not to be obese and even to grow up to be young adults who continue to eat healthily. And then there are all the mental health benefits, lower rates of high-risk teenage behaviors like substance abuse and teenage pregnancy and tobacco use and depression and anxiety. I mean, I do joke that if families had regular family dinners, I could be out of business because isn't this exactly what I try to do as a family therapist?
Do you think that this works in families where there are all kinds of issues of timing and socioeconomic stress and, you know, places where there are food deserts where you wouldn't have access to the kinds of high nutrition foods? Or is it just work in, you know, in the Leave It to Beaver setting?
This is certainly not Leave It to Beaver propaganda. You know, I'm not talking about a 1950s idealized mother in the kitchen, spotless stove, and so on. Of course, kids in low-income families are eating fewer family dinners than they did 15 years ago, and high-income kids are eating more. So this is a worrisome sign of economic disparity. But I think family dinner is really for all people, and no matter what the income level, the obstacles are often the same, and that is time. You know, everybody is reporting that they're feeling overscheduled and too busy. And I think there are many ways that we can get around that creatively. Breakfast works, a planned family snack where everybody comes together and stops doing their homework and has a healthy snack together and talks and feels engaged with one another. So we don't have to be wedded to it being dinner. Really, any meal that kids feel that they have a chance to talk about what's on their minds and parents are listening and there's laughter, this can be achieved in any kind of family. With the Family Dinner Project, we have resources online that are available for free for families that give ideas about meals that are very inexpensive to make, meals that can be made with things that you have on hand. So I think there are lots of ways that dinner can be and must be accessible to families of all income levels.
Scientifically, it's striking how settled a question this is, in that each study produces very positive results and really, you know, it's not nuanced. It's a big gain that you get from this. And I'm just wondering why, prior to your synthesis of all of this, wasn't this as well known? Wasn't this as, you know, recommended and talked about as a therapeutic solution until you came along?
That's an interesting question, John. I really don't know why it hasn't been more widely promulgated as an idea. There may have been a little bit of a cloud over family dinner, as you know, as we were talking about at the beginning, as a sort of throwback, old-fashioned idea. That's really too bad because it has been so updated. And actually, I think of it as being part of making gender equity more possible. You know, as we teach women to lean in at work, we can and should be teaching our sons to lean in the kitchen. And this is really a major change in family dinner. Men are cooking way more than they did 20 years ago. I think the latest statistic is that 42% of men are cooking. So I hope the message gets out that family dinners are really so beneficial and really not that hard to make happen.
Ann Fischel is director of the Family and Couples Therapy Program at Mass General Hospital and co-founder of the Family Dinner Project. She's the author of Home for Dinner, Mixing Food, Fun, and Conversation for a Happier Family and Healthier Kids. Ann, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
You can find more of Ann's Family Dinner Games and a link to the Family Dinner Project at thetakeaway.org. There are lots of great tips in her book, Home for Dinner, Mixing Food, Fun, and Conversation for a Happier Family and Healthier Kids.
I'm Nicole from Tampa, Florida. Every Christmas, my great-aunt Violet brought her homemade wine, and I got to have a small glass of it. It was so sweet that it was like candy. Afterwards, she shouted about those dirty politicians, which I will never forget. She was a spitfire.
One memory is my dad teaching me to say butter in Portuguese, one of you from Austin, Texas. It sparked my love of languages, which continues today. And the word butter?
Manteiga.
Give us a call. Share your memories. The number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Manteiga.
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 Manteiga. Public radio is about giving. Listeners love to give. Listeners like Alec Baldwin.
And I've come here to your public radio station during your sad little pledge drive with a simple message. Don't give.
Why, thank you, Alec. And here's a little musical offering from singer Jackie Naylor to help with the pledge drive.
This is the spot for NPR.
Some people seem a little desperate sometimes. Desperate to give back. To just say thank you.
Kitty Kelly likes me, Susan Lurie, Glenn Scarlett, Jack Spear, April Bear, David Folkins.
Shut it down!
So when we heard about artist and producer T.J. Reynolds and his complete CD called NPR, where he created hip-hop tunes to celebrate the public radio shows he loves, we were a little skeptical. Until we listened and realized this wasn't some simple reciting of names or cloying how many hosts can we get into the lyric kind of thing. Reynolds has used hip-hop to try and capture the spirit and essence of the shows he loves. And I'm just glad our show is one of them.
What is the takeaway? What did we learn from love that we made to bridges we burn? What is the takeaway? What have we got for every advancement of the bomb that we drop? What is the takeaway?
It's bringing something to life in a new way. It's combining two things that were maybe unrelated in my life, but pretty constant, hip-hop and NPR together.
Well, talking about the takeaway for just a moment, what is this sort of quality of the takeaway that emerges in this sample here?
It's the kind of thing that a hip-hop producer really looks for. It's got little phrases that you can kind of rearrange, but the notes and the tone of them are really distinctive. So even when you rearrange them, you know, your mind knows it and it knows where it comes from.
Are you the top dog? Couldn't have planned it without you. Because at the same time, we're moving toward the betterment. We balance out with detriment and race it towards our imminent destruction. Sucks when government don't function. They shake, you strike, you scrape, you like percussion.
And in terms of the lyrics, I mean, the rhymes, there's a feel of intensity that is not unrelated to this show.
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine, like, you see the biggest news stories that come along and you break them down and all the crazy stuff that happens in the world, you know, you deal with and you hear people's perspectives that are right there dealing with it, and it's got to be Sorry, I kind of lost my train of thought there.
Well, no, you didn't, because it is what we're doing. What have we got? I mean, that's what we're saying. Yeah. We ask ourselves every day.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, what is coming from it? Have we learned a lesson because we keep doing the same things over and over again as a species? We build great things, and then we destroy them. We tear them right down, you know? So how are we advancing for everything that we have, you know? Why do so many brilliant minds go back to weaponry? Why do these great inventions get turned back into weapons?
Well, you're editorializing now, and that's totally fine. And we've had those discussions on the show, but it's very pragmatic. What have we learned? You know, what's fresh?
Mm-hmm.
These are the questions we ask every day. I mean, it's like your lyrics are straight out of our editorial meeting.
Yeah, well, that's high praise, because I mean, I'm definitely trying to capture the essence of the shows when I break them down on the album. So, yeah.
Well, let's do what you do with Marketplace, right?
But first, let's do the numbers.
I'm throwing down, hoping it all falls in place. I'm just carving out my niche in the marketplace. We bout to take it all, don't stall, make haste. I'm just carving out my niche in the marketplace. So what I'm selling, I hope that you're buying. I'm talking about the message that I'll be supplying.
So this is a little more of a commentary on the subject matter of Marketplace, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sensing a little Tupac in there, I'd say.
I always related to Tupac and how he was able to just really riff on a subject and really get into it and you know, have some wordplay and write something very lyrical while still conveying a definite message. And that's the direction I was trying to go in with the album. As artists, we get big ideas all the time. And I think the way to create something successful is to keep making creative decisions along the way. And this was a project where I was able to really have fun within it, and the idea wasn't just the big picture and then plugging away at it. I really got to get into it and kind of discover new things as I was doing this.
My niche in the marketplace. We about to take it all, don't stall, make haste. I'm just carving out my niche in the marketplace. So
what's been the reaction of public radio people who you ran this by?
Well, I haven't been sued yet, so that's a big plus.
You can raise the bar a little higher than that, I think.
People have been really digging it, and it's finding its little niche audience of people that dig, you know, both of those worlds together. And I've been really enjoying going for the ride. I'm riding a wave right now. I'm in the Takeaway studio.
Well, has anybody talked to you from the mothership down there in D.C.?
No, I haven't made contact with the mothership, but I'm still sending out signals. So, you know.
So you haven't been like jamming with my brother Robert Siegel, you know?
We're gonna get to Robert. Robert, you're listening right now, so let's make this happen, man. We got to get you on a track, get you a guest verse, so you can drop a hot 16 on the world.
It's just it. All things considered, we made it a long way. Amazing that we even made it out alive. All things considered, we got it together, but I don't think we should be that surprised. All things considered.
Can you do a rhyme with Siegel?
Oh, yeah.
He's a host, Robert Siegel.
He keeps it real regal.
Yeah.
Soaring from Russia back to the Desert Eagle.
Nice.
Send a shout out, keep him laughing, all the people.
Tell him a joke. He might not hear that you spoke.
Uh-huh. But at least he knows that he got you awoke.
That's good.
You might be suddenly hearing the blues, but even when you're laughing, you're getting the news.
Siegel, he's been there for so long. But if we were to lose him, it would be so wrong.
It would be so wrong.
So wrong. What was your inspiration? I'm a little bit worried that maybe you spent a lot of time in the back of a hot station wagon having to listen to NPR from your parents.
Yeah. My parents did listen to NPR, but it was really, I think, something I discovered on my own after I moved out. And, you know, all that stuff that you listen to NPR, it's on in the back of the car. And, you know, you want to listen to whatever, like, Kids Bop song is happening. But as you get older, you discover it for yourself. And you know, different shows connect to you on a different level, and the theme songs and the music just becomes a soundtrack of your life. So it's like making songs out of these shows people feel a great connection to, because these shows are part of their everyday life, and you know, it's refreshing.
All right. Well, TJ, this is great. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been awesome.
TJ Reynolds, whose album NPR has remixed numerous themes of public radio shows, including The Takeaway. And here's something to take with you today. Back to the 80s fans will thrill to the announcement that the 1982 DeLorean car is going back into production. A change in federal law for low-volume manufacturers has accomplished what not even an alleged big infusion of drug money could do. About 9,000 DeLoreans were made before founder, the late John DeLorean's company, went bankrupt and he was prosecuted for money laundering. Now a company in Houston will start making the Back to the Future movie cars for a sticker price somewhere north of $100,000. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.